From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on January 28, 1986, 33 years ago this week, at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The Space Shuttle Challenger was set to launch after numerous delays, and for the first time in the history of the space program, a teacher would go to space. Krista McAuliffe was selected to serve as a payload specialist on the mission as part of Ronald Reagan's Teacher in Space project. A large crowd, including McAuliffe's parents, gathered at Cape Canaveral the day of the launch. Spirits, of course, were very high, and when the shuttle took off, cheers rang across the bleachers. And where were you? Cheers probably rang across so many American classrooms and office buildings and college campuses. But just 73 seconds into that flight, something went wrong, and the shuttle exploded. At first, the spectators gathered in the bleachers in Florida seemed to think that the smoke they saw in the sky was perhaps another part of takeoff. But then the elation turned to confusion. Mission Control was silent, and moments later, Mission Control announced that the space shuttle had exploded. The Challenger disaster changed the course of space exploration, and according to many writers, it ended the age of space innocence. But scientists, teachers, and family members of the Challenger crew wanted to keep the goals and memories of the astronauts alive, and that, in part, led to the founding of Challenger Learning Centers across the country. The centers allow students to go on simulated missions, learning about everything involved in space travel, and the center in Rochester is one of only 40 in the country and was the second center founded. Hundreds of thousands of teachers and students in our area have experienced the missions as students and teachers and thousands across the country have done. And those missions have been happening at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. But now, they're gearing up for a move to a new home. This hour, we talk to mission commanders from Rochester's Challenger Learning Center about their work, what they hope students can learn, and how we teach space exploration 33 years after the Challenger tragedy. We also want to hear your memories from that day. We'll get to that later in the hour. I want to welcome our guests now, two mission commanders for the Challenger Learning Center in Rochester. Andy Reb. Andy, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us, Evan.
And Peter Robeson. Peter, welcome. Thank you as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is one of those American moments that, as long as you were alive and have memories of that day, you will always have that sort of indelibly in your mind. And as I mentioned, listeners, we'll share your memories later in the hour. I already have a lot to share from that day. I want to ask both of you to set the scene for where you were and how it hit you. And I will start with Andy. Go ahead.
Well, I was born and raised in Webster here in Rochester, and I was a student at Schrader Junior High School at the time, ninth grade. And you have to recall that this was before social media. There was no internet. There was no Instagram, Snapchat, or Facebook. And so every kid in the country knew who those astronauts were, knew who the seven Challenger astronauts were. We knew them by name. And yet, without social media, with only three television channels, every kid that I knew had a model of the space shuttle or a poster of the space shuttle in their room. And so the excitement was just off the charts. I mean, this was a mission that was dedicated to us. It was dedicated to kids for us, having a teacher in space. So it was meaningful in a way that no prior mission had been. And this one felt very real for us. And I will never forget just watching it with my classroom, having it on TV, the principal getting on the PA saying, everybody stop what you're doing, pencils down, turn on your televisions to this, you know, whatever channels, all three of them broadcasting
it. Yep.
And it's one of those events where you cannot get it out of your mind. It will stay with me forever. But at the time, it was confusing and it was shocking. And I think I remember the evening of the event more than the actual event, because after it had sunk in and after the realization had crystallized that they were gone and that they weren't coming back, it was then that we realized, oh my goodness, what has happened? And to this day, I sometimes struggle sharing this and teaching this with the kids, with the students, to find the appropriate words to put it in context for them. Because for us, it's very real, and it's very heartfelt and still a raw memory that doesn't go away. For them, it's ancient history. So at the Challenger Learning Center, we have a mandate and we have a job to make it meaningful for kids by sharing our experiences and then propelling it forward to an experience for the students to enjoy.
I want to, if we could, let's listen to some of the audio from Mission Command that day. And I think this not only captures the abruptness, but also some of the confusion. Let's listen.
3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Engines at 65%, 3 engines running normally, 3 good fuel cells, 3 good APUs. Engines throttling up, 3 engines now at 104%.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
1 minute, 15 seconds. Velocity, 2,900 feet per second. Altitude, 9 nautical miles. Downrange distance, 7 nautical miles. We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
I mean, it's...
Still shivers.
Yeah. It's just, it sort of still feels unreal.
It does.
So, Andy, and you know, you guys are both a little bit older than me. I was in second grade, and my recollection is there was a TV in the corner of the classroom. We were all watching. The whole class was watching. The moment that we just heard is where it starts to get blurry for me in my memory, because I remember a confused look on my teacher's face. And then from there, it's sort of hazy. It's like everybody was bewildered. It went from this elation, this national celebration, we're going to watch in class, we're going to celebrate, we're all going to dream of our own space careers, to I don't even understand what I just saw. And I don't remember exactly the rest of that. You were saying that for you, you almost remember that evening more than the event. Do you have much recollection of those moments after it was clear that a disaster had happened?
I do recall just the silence in my classroom.
Yeah.
And I believe my teacher knew before we did, you know, was able to articulate it before we did. And I almost think that there was an effort on the part of the teachers at the time to sort of insulate us a little bit from the shock of what had just transpired and sort of hold it in check, but explain it in a way that only teachers can do. A horrible moment, but a teachable one nevertheless.
I think that silence is probably pretty common from what you've heard other people sharing their stories. Would you agree with that? That short shocked silence?
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
Peter, what's your recollection? You were in college at the time?
Yeah, I was a freshman in college. I'd had a rough first semester, so I was just back maybe a week. I was in Dr. Waite's class. I was a technology education student, so I was already involved in wanting to be an educator. And I went to Professor Waite with that pleading that only a 19-year-old, you know, homesick freshman can do, and this is really important to me. I've been waiting to watch this. I would spend most of my summers in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and Krista McAuliffe was in the next town up in Concord. So I had, honestly, I had gone past her school dozens of times through those middle years. And boy, I sprinted, if you know the college campus at all, from the tech facilities all the way over to Cayuga Hall is a long run. And I remember getting into the lobby and you're peeling off your coat and yet you're sweating. So it's freezing and yet you get in front of this television with minutes to spare. And then I can remember almost standing on the couch in excitement with probably a half a dozen other students watching. And there was that liftoff and, you know, the high fives and the elation. And then in those moments, and Andy said this, you know, we are sharing something that we were witness to with these young children in our environment at the Challenger Center. And every once in a while, it surprises me. I still have to sometimes pause because you get choked up. And when that explosion occurred, initially, I just remember the clouds, you know, not really sure if it's smoke, but something. And I don't think I realized the significance of what I was watching in that moment until they panned the camera and they caught the solid rocket booster no longer connected to the shuttle, flying off and twirling out of control. And at that point, I don't think anyone needed to say anything. We knew. And I can only imagine what a classroom teacher would have needed to do in that moment there's this chaos. You have your own emotions to manage. And yet, as teachers, and as I have tried to do so in my own life and my own home and family, your hope is to respond rather than to react. But an event of that type just takes you completely off guard. And I remember walking back into my dorm room and then just needing to walk around. And then eventually I went back to the lobby to watch. And then I made certain to watch that night. President Reagan, boy, you're going way back. He was already intended, I believe, to make his presidential address that night to the nation. Mm-hmm. And then use that opportunity to meet us in those in this sorrow and in this shock. So there's a large portion of that day that's still a part of me. So I bring it with me every day, and I try to remind myself that I was there with the anticipation of watching my teacher, right, Krista McAuliffe. She was personal to every one of us. And I was waiting to watch my teacher from space. And instead, I lost my teacher. And that was really tough. That was a brutal day.
I'm then curious to know, as painful and emotional as that was for mm-hmm. you, for both of you, for all Americans, but these are formative years. Mm-hmm. That could have been a moment where you thought, well, the last thing I will do is anything related to a space program because of the fear, the hurt. We kind of touched on this in the intro that a lot of writers do call that the end of the age of innocence of the space program, and maybe fairly yes. so, probably fairly so. Why then? And Peter, I'll start with you on this. I mean, would you have, if I would have talked to that 19-year-old that day
yeah.
and told him you're going to be Commander Robeson?
Right. Yeah.
Would that have been hard for you to sort of take in?
Was not on the radar back then at all, even a consideration. I don't know. For me, Evan, I think one of the things, though, is that these were explorers, right? There was inherent risk. They knew that. And so they accepted that. And I'm sure that these conversations were had, long, hard, deep conversations with family, knowing full well that I could be lost. We don't reflect on other explorers in that way. We don't think of explorers mm-hmm. coming home. Most did not. Many did not. Those that sought the North Pole, they didn't make it. Shackleton was the exception, right? Ernest Shackleton, by some miraculous, really survived that. But the loss of those astronauts, I think, made space exploration real again. We were witnessing in that time, 20 space shuttles per month. They had become routine to the point where many weren't even being televised. And in that moment of loss, I think the reality of the extreme of what we were doing with our abilities at that time with technology and such and reaching out to a new landscape became real again. This is not a game. This is real work. There is real risk. And I do believe you're correct. And in what you said, it was a loss of innocence, but it was a stark reminder that these things are hard. And ultimately, that's what JFK had said as we reached out to the moon. We choose to do these things not because they're easy, but because they're hard. And we were in a collaborative effort with, at the time, with enemies of the Cold War, with the Russians, in this international effort to build the space station. And we were paramount to the success of that because of our Challenger shuttles being the payload specialties. So,
did you ever have a moment where, as your career started to move in certain directions, you thought back to the Challenger and it gave you more pause, or did that give you more determination?
Well, we lost Columbia on February the 1st of 2003. And by that point, I was in the classroom.
Yeah.
And yes, that was another moment where you're struggling to teach in the midst of this loss. How do you relate that kind of information to young, impressionable minds that are caught up in the moment, and instead of excitement and joy, which was the intent, now they're dealing with frustration, confusion, fear. So yes, I've reflected often on the Challenger. And then when you're given this opportunity to work at a living memorial, which to this day, I am humbled and honored to be a part of this program. I want to make sure that everything, and I know I'm speaking on behalf of Andy, we do not have the luxury of having a bad day. We have to be on spot every day because we have one moment to inspire children in the way in which we were inspired, or in our case, watching the shuttle shocked. Those 73 seconds have stuck with me for 33 years, mm-hmm. and they still teach me every day.
Andy, did they, I guess, let's see, you were 15. Did those seconds deter you at all? If I would have talked to that 15-year-old and said, do you know what your career is going to be? And that's a lot for any 15-year-old to take in, but what would you have thought about that?
Yeah, Evan, I think my answer is going to be a little different because I grew up a science fiction and fantasy fan, and I think it's in humans' DNA to want to explore. It's part of us. It's hardwired in, and it was a setback, but it wasn't the first. You know, Apollo 1 in 1967, right. And that was January 27th, ironically enough. All of these three space tragedies take place within the span of 4 days of each other, Apollo, Challenger, and Columbia. If you'd have told me at that age that I was going to be Commander Rab, I think I would have stood up and high-fived you and hugged you and,
wow.
and whooped and hollered. Despite the tragedies, despite the setbacks, it's in our nature to want to know what's out there. It's in our nature to crave this sort of adventure and to explore space. And so for me, I remember that year, of course, growing up sci-fi and growing up Star Wars and Star Trek. That year in November, the fourth Star Trek film came out, and there was a dedication to the Challenger 7 before the film started, right on the title card. And it was consistent with the Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry's vision of space exploration and a diverse group of people going out and solving problems as a team. And I think for me, that was almost therapeutic in a way to remind me that, yes, this is an optimistic future despite these setbacks. Let's be part of it. And boy, oh boy, if I can't get into space when I'm a grown up, mm-hmm. Then maybe I can be involved in some way on the ground. If you would have told me that all these years later that I would be Commander Rab, I would have cried tears of joy.
Yeah. So that brings us to where we are and why we're here this hour. It's not just because it's the week commemorating the loss of the Challenger, but also because Challenger Learning Centers, well, at least here in Rochester, there's some big decisions that have to be made. And listeners, if you don't really know what it is, let's kind of walk through this. So this goes back to 2001 now here in Rochester. Is that right?
Well, it actually goes further back than that. That was our inclusion in Challenger. So the formation of the Challenger Centers actually began here back in, what, 1990?
About 1990.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so
it didn't take long. Yeah. The surviving families of the astronauts decided that they wanted to have a memorial for the Challenger 7. What's unique, and I think what's remarkable, is they didn't say, let's put something in Washington that's a monument. Let's make a plaque someplace.
Everyone would have understood.
Correct.
Which
is there at Arlington.
Right, but I mean, you could sort of stand pat with that
and
say, that's going to be the living legacy.
And
right?
And there are such monuments that exist today, but for June Scobie Rogers, who was the wife of the pilot Dick Scobie, mm-hmm. to say, you know what, we have to turn this tragedy into a triumph, into something positive. We have to remember what the mission was originally intended to do, and that is inspire kids about their futures and about space. And so the idea of creating this living memorial, this mm-hmm. environment of immersion and adventure and excitement where we honor the astronauts with reverence, but also celebrate them with joy, it's not what you would expect. It's really unexpected. And I mm-hmm. think that's what sets it apart and makes it so unique. Mm-hmm. But we're so fortunate that here in Rochester, we're blessed to have all these efforts that have taken place since 1990. We had Carol O'Leary, who was a BOCES employee who was working under the assistant superintendent, Jerry Cummings, and the superintendent, Joe Farinola, and a teacher, Linda Smith, who said, let's check this out. So they got a team of superintendents from the area to go down to Virginia all together and observe the first Challenger Learning Center that had opened and say, we need this. We want this for our schools in Rochester. We want every kid in our community to experience this. Mm-hmm. And for that to happen, it's nothing short of a miracle for that to actually happen. Because now, all these years later, we find ourselves in a position of sustainability. But to get that even started, it's really astonishing that that effort was made.
And I think it's noteworthy too, Andy, that Linda Smith was a teacher at Rush Henrietta. She's the one that came to me to ask me about my, you know, interest in the Challenger Center, but before that, the Bubble Project, which was the underwater labs. Linda Smith was a finalist. You know, there were 11,000 teachers that applied for this opportunity. And although Krista McAuliffe was selected, Linda was in those final, you know, moments of selection consideration. So you have this teacher that could have potentially been on board of the shuttle. And then after its loss, here she is now a catalyst in seeing this living memorial created. And I think one of the things that my age group, perhaps, Krista McAuliffe was on television all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things.
Magazine covers. I mean, there was a ton
parades.
Of absolutely.
Yeah. She said, more or less, I have this dream, and our children should dream, and teachers have a dream that someday we'll have this global village for all peoples, and it will be the new frontier, which was space. And her dream was to educate all of these children and to bring this joy of learning. And I think that really emphasizes everything that she was and is as an educator. And that crew, they were doing this with a joy of learning, and they wanted to bring kids with them so that they would dream beyond what they were comfortable with and look for this, you know, reach for the stars. That was one of her things.
Rochester's Challenger Center was the second in the nation. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
And still with us now, but there are some changes afoot here, and listeners probably ought to know about that, because if you're hearing this now, especially because there's a lot of kids off school and you're thinking about all these great things you could do with kids or
snow day,
what schools may want to think about doing for education, the Challenger Learning Center is maybe going to move. I guess that's the best case.
Before we start that, Evan,
yeah.
I just want to say that when kids come to us in the winter like this, and we had a group from Webster and from Fairport yesterday who came in, and I greeted them at the door with a big smile, and I said, "Aren't you glad they didn't cancel school today?" It's one of those days where the kids pray there won't be a snow day when they're coming to the Challenger Learning Center.
I love that.
Yeah.
And there's so much that's changed, by the way. That's a whole separate discussion. Kids will never know the joy and pain of waiting to see your school across the scroll on the screen. Everybody knows everything on your phones these days. Kids, you have no idea what it was like
sitting there in your pajamas waiting.
Exactly. But sure enough, you're right. There are days that everyone wanted to be there, wanted to go. And,
yes.
And you guys welcome how many schools on an annual basis?
We are seeing in the neighborhood, if you include our summer camps, mm-hmm. we are working with somewhere between 8,500 and 10,000 students a year.
Wow.
Yeah, we see a lot of young people.
That's in person.
That's in person.
That doesn't include,
right.
We also do video conferencing. We're a distance learning network mm-hmm. as part of our STEM hub status. So we broaden our reach by expanding with content programs to various schools across the country. I talked to Kettering, Ohio last week. Peter spoke with
Nunavut, Canada, yes. which is on the Arctic Circle.
Oh, cool.
So the reach has been, we've spoken with students in Nova Scotia, Dexter, Maine, Alaska, a number of times in Alaska, actually.
So this little Challenger Learning Center with the two of us running it is able to have this global reach and become sort of a STEM center for the United States, if not the globe, which is really exciting.
And Commanders, when students locally come and see you in person,
yes.
what do they get to experience?
Well, we have a mock NASA facility. They walk in and it looks like Mission Control. The beauty is that we also have our own spaceship, known as the Explorer 2. So we do a pre-flight briefing with a whole collection of students, say 28. Oftentimes, I think Webster yesterday probably had almost a dozen parents with them. So this is this family experience. We do the pre-flight briefing. We are responsible for launching a new probe to Mars. So Team B will board our Explorer 2 spacecraft, where the construction of a probe takes place. While Team A, those working within the mission control, provide all the support and do all of the data entry. After the hopeful successful launch of a probe and landing, we are then tasked with retrieving a crew of astronauts that have lived on the red planet, Mars, for 2 years. So then the student groups switch. So the students that begin in Mission Control now board the craft with a rescue retrieve operation, and the students that had begun in the spacecraft return to Mission Control and provide that support staff.
I'll tell you, Evan, I'm a huge Disney-phile. I love immersive experiences, mm-hmm. and these kind of experiences where you get to role play and be a part of the adventure. I've been to Disney. I've been to numerous places. There is nothing like it anywhere that offers this level of immersion and taking on and assuming the role of an astronaut. You won't find a public school child who will ever be in support of wearing a uniform to school. But when we tell them you're going to put your uniform on when you come in, it elicits a cheer from the group, which is which is just delightful. Here's a fun fact also. As part of the scenario, we interact with a recorded video of astronauts from the future who are on Mars.
That's right.
And the commander of that vessel, Spirit One, is played by a woman who was the assistant superintendent at the time who hired Peter and I. And you may know her. Her name is Bonnie Garner. And just a shout out to Bonnie.
Yep.
She is just a tremendous force for helping keep a Challenger alive and keeping it meaningful for us.
I like to think that we see Bonnie every day.
I talk to her every day.
We do.
Yes.
She's terrific.
Well, and so now, after all of this work that you have done educating students in our community, working with these districts, providing these experiences, you are facing some change. So the reality now for the Challenger Learning Center is what in Rochester?
So our lease and our work with the museum comes to a close at the end of June. And with that, there is a need for a new location. So we have had the support of our superintendent, Dan White, and our director, Steve Orcott, and Lisa Ryan and Michelle Ryan, who are in the business office. And we have worked diligently to find a new location, and we have had some tremendous help with people from the community in finding this location. And we are now poised to relocate to the Kodak Performing Arts Center up on Ridge Road. And we will be in a 4,000-square-foot facility, which is on the first floor just around the corner from their new space museum, all the pictures that Kodak has been portioned to and from related to the space program. Now, I say that knowing that we are still awaiting board approval. So this is still tentative, but it is pending. And
you'll find out when?
I believe it's next week. There's a board meeting with a final vote for that final approval. And pending such approval, the relocation will begin on June the 17th or 18th, and we intend to be in-house at the Kodak facility and ready to have students begin joining us again by October of the 2019 school year.
Okay, now I have to ask some blunt questions because I know you guys are mission commanders at the Challenger Learning Center. You know, you're not accountants. But I have to ask because when you're looking at a move like this, there were a lot of rumblings at least a few weeks ago that, oh, did you hear the Challenger Center could close? The Challenger Center could close, could be gone. And you can move to Kodak. I imagine there's some money involved. I also, I haven't seen your books, but I imagine some of your money, or maybe most of the money to fund what you're doing comes from what districts pay to send students there. Is that correct?
That's correct. All of our funding comes from school dollars.
School dollars just sending students to get the experience.
It is not a mandated program, and that is our challenge. It's a program that is cherished. It's a program of value. But it is non-mandated. However, because it's a BOCES program, there is a reimbursement involved for the school dollars from the state. So they do get state aid on what they pay towards our program, which is tremendous.
But you don't have another separate funding stream that's going to...
Well, not quite. We have a, outside of the Challenger Learning Center, when it was established, there's a wall of donors who got it started and assisted back in 1990 to bring the Challenger to Rochester. And fortunately, we haven't had to dial them or call them in all of these years. We've been able to sustain the Challenger Learning Center just doing what we're doing. So it's been exciting. A move like this, Peter's having to hold me back because
I think we're both
bursting at the seams with excitement,
yes.
Evan. What Peter didn't share is this is double the space of what we have right now. Mm-hmm. We get to build a better spaceship, and we get to have two video conferencing studios right next to each other a space that allows for expansion, for professional development for teachers. Not only is Challenger poised to be a STEM facility for students to benefit, but for also for teachers to come in and learn some skills or learn some technologies that then they will take back to their classroom.
And one of the big pushes now within school districts is this STEM facility, or they call it a makerspace. And the equipment is expensive and the training is difficult and much of it's self-taught. And Andy and I are hoping to incorporate a makerspace within this new facility, and we can then become the training ground, and we would also then be the educators helping other educators incorporate these new skill sets into their classroom environment or into a makerspace within their school building. And the mission control room itself will double in size. We have new interactive touch screens, and they're not smart boards. They're interactive touch screens where we can have students do work on a screen. We can actually capture that digitally into a PDF file, download it now to our website for further access from teachers back in the classroom. So one of the concerns that we've always had is that there are some that may perceive this as this two-hour experience, and they come in and it starts and they walk out and it ends. What we have is a pre-flight video conference. So every school district locally that chooses to, which is a portion of their fee, they interact with us for an hour to 90 minutes before they come. And then all of this experience is now something the teacher can draw from as he or she excites them prior to, let's say, an exam or introduction to a new thought or a new curriculum area within the science field. And that's why we try to make sure that we are very much a STEM program and STEM facility. But the costs are real. And we're sheltered from some of that, but you're right. It's a big move.
So unfortunately, I have to bring it back to the money one more time. And I promise in our second half hour, we're about to dive through some listener feedback, and there's so much here.
Terrific.
When it comes to raising funds, you guys are not professional fundraisers. Are you sort of sitting here now, though, knowing that without new donors, you may not be able to exist as a learning center anymore?
We're going to be in trouble later. Yes, I am concerned. And I think Andy is concerned and our director is concerned. And anyone that's working within education knows that moves, let's just put out a number of $150,000, are not part of a budget. They're just not. So the move is going to be significant. We have to disassemble an entire facility, transport it to a new location, reassemble it, and then our intent is to expand. So the costs are real. They're high. I'm sure they're higher than we've even expected or been anticipating. But yet, here we are as the second oldest learning facility of its kind in the country and as a living memorial. Neither one of us want to see this close. In fact, what we would like to do is leave it in better shape as a gift to the next generation to explore. And
wait, you're not talking about retiring, are you, Commander Robeson?
No, I don't think it's going
to
happen.
I plan to be there for quite some time still.
Have both of you, have you honestly had to consider in recent weeks, if we don't have people step up and contribute, this may be the end of the center?
We've had those conversations together behind our closed doors and with our families. It's not a comfortable conversation, but I think
it's a heavy weight that we've been sort of pushing aside every time a school group comes in, because we want to, that's transparent. We want to keep that away from our students and our teachers from worrying about. Mm-hmm. That's not their problem.
And Evan, consider this. We both left our school districts by choice to come here. So, here we were in this venture, this new frontier. We left our comfort and in order to do this. And so now we have become comfortable because we've been here for 18 years, and you're faced with this change. Welcomed or unwelcomed, there is change in front of us. And as you know, change is often difficult, and there's much that goes into those challenges.
Sure. And I understand if you guys wanted to spend all your days raising money, you would have run for Congress, because that's what they do. But but you guys are mission commanders at the Challenger Learning Center, so we always say, WXXI and Connections, we can't endorse any charities or giving organizations, but if people want to contact you, if they want to support you and find a way to do that, what's the best way for them to do that?
Our website is www.rochesterchallenger.org. That's rochesterchallenger.org. And the director of the program is Steve Orcutt. That's O-R-C-U-T-T. And he would be the person to get in contact if you want to help in any way. We are going to need people to even help move. So there's a lot of things that can be done to help.
And I'll throw out a phone number. And our clerk and friend and
Oh.
Amy Vallone is our secretary that manages to schedule 17 school districts trying to fit into our facility.
I wouldn't call
in
her so much
day.
A secretary,
no,
so much as an agent in the chair.
That she is. But her direct number is a 585-383-2290. And I'm sure she'll thank me for saying that on the radio at some later time today.
That's okay. You're hearing mission commanders for the Challenger Learning Center in Rochester, Peter Robeson and Andy Rabb. And they are with us because we're talking about 33 years since the loss of the Challenger, the reality of the past and the present and the future of the space program, and what the Rochester Challenger Learning Center is trying to do as it gets ready for a potential move to a new location if they have the funds to survive this change. So this was only the second Challenger Center constructed in the country. Rochester, second on the list, just 4 or 5 years after the loss of the Challenger. So let's go ahead and get our only break of the hour. When we come back, we've got a lot of your feedback to weave in as you remember where you were in 1986, January 28th, when that national celebration turned into a national tragedy. And our guests are trying to not only help keep teaching from that, but also trying to rebuild the excitement and enthusiasm in a positive direction. So let's get that break and come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, it depends on what you're into that will tell you how you know Ryan Miller. You might know him as the lead singer of Guster, one of the very successful touring bands of the last 25 years who were just in Rochester. Or maybe you know him as a PBS television host with a couple of shows under his belt. Maybe you know him for his film score work. One of the most interesting people I've sat down with, Ryan Miller, next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Let me go ahead and start reading some of your feedback here as we remember 33 years since the loss of the Challenger. Jane writes to us, Evan, I was 7 years old and in the second grade. Krista McAuliffe was supposed to visit our elementary school the following month to talk about the journey. We watched in school and we were devastated. I remember Reagan's speech, and I especially remember the very special episode of Punky Brewster about it. I know people probably say, oh, that was cheesy or what have you, but the way they had Punky react was very relatable and resonated with me as a child. That's from Jane. Yeah, I'm with you, Jane. I don't remember watching the Punky Brewster episode, but so many people have called our attention to it and had the exact same feeling that we all needed something. Kids needed something to kind of relate to, and that was one of them.
Yeah, it's interesting how pop culture reacts, Evan. There was a movie that was in production in 1986 called Space Camp. And the movie was about a group of kids that go to space camp, accidentally launch in a shuttle, and then find themselves in jeopardy of getting home. And then you have the tragedy happen, and then they still have this movie to release. So it's an interesting follow-up to the tragedy when you have this film that's meant to inspire and get kids excited about it. So like that Punky Brewster episode, I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who remember that as well.
Absolutely. Let me go ahead and get Tom from Brighton on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, good conversation. Certainly the loss of the astronauts in all three of the fatal accidents was a terrible loss, and we're quite correct and proper to memorialize them at this time. But I have to say, the three accidents were really result of negligence, in my opinion, on the part of the management of the space program. First, the three astronauts that died in the Apollo 1 capsule, they were in a 100% oxygen environment, which left zero margin for error. So when a spark started, the entire capsule was consumed in a few moments. The three astronauts were killed. The two space shuttles that were destroyed, both of them suffered from a lack of quality design to take into account low temperatures that ultimately destroyed both vehicles. The O-rings weren't designed to withstand the cold on that particular day, and the other, Columbia was destroyed because it was hit by some ice that fell off the top of the gantry. In both of those situations, you know, definitely, I have a background in quality. They should have been dealt with in the design process. They weren't. Now, part of the reason was there was still the after effect of the space race that we're in with the Soviets, so there was some cutting of corners. But that, I think, was the major reason for those accidents. And going forward, I don't like saying this because I get excited by manned space travel. But in 2019, all of the technical data that we'll look for when we go into space can be obtained through automated robotic spacecraft. It's no longer necessary to put men and women into space.
Tom, I appreciate the perspective there. I'll ask commanders to respond. Go ahead.
Well, Tom, thank you for calling and thank you for the thoughts. I think there's a blend of both where applicable. I think artificial intelligence can take us far. There are talks about if we are going to propel forward to planet Mars, which is our focus, which is NASA's destination, that it would need to be done with the assistance of automation. And in fact, there are plans to build a colony on Mars. Now, that sounds like a lot of heavy lifting. And the idea would be to have robots, automaton, go to Mars and construct the colony and have it waiting for the astronauts when they arrive, which to me is the best of both worlds, because you have, again, humankind reaching forward to its nearest neighbor in the solar system, propelling on and exploring, and then working to solve problems and having those menial tasks that are a waste of the talent of our well-trained astronauts and problem solvers being handled by robots. I think that, you know, the marriage of the two, I think, is where the future is headed. Let's hope.
Yeah, and Evan, he was very informed. I mean, very well informed. And yes, those oversights were known. In fact, the night before the Challenger launched, there was endless argument and concern raised about never having tested a launch under 52 degrees Fahrenheit. And yet here we are. We have astronauts that have been on board the space station for over a year. Sonny Williams, we have Scott Kelly. They're doing live broadcasts from outer space. And they contacted and reached out and spoke to classrooms for a year and spoke to over a million students while in orbit from the International Space Station. So there's still this zeal and this excitement. And honestly, there's that ever-present question, what's out there? And I don't know that we will excite people to even consider space exploration, whether you send robots or otherwise, unless there's that human piece, that human
great
connection.
Great point, Peter.
And that's what we do as people. I will work with a robot. I will interact with a robot. I don't know that I'll ever be excited by a robot. And there's that factor that we must still inspire our young people to consider greatness and to reach out to explore things they don't know. And this is why we still look. Look to the stars.
Well said, Peter. You know, one of the things that we do with our video conferences, Evan, is we provide a program called Astronauts Living the Dream, where we show the wide spectrum of space exploration. We show humans in space. We show robots in space, the latest robotics. And the kids are excited when we show them the Boston Dynamics robots. They think it's neat. But keep in mind, those same kids have seen computer-generated special effects that look like that. They get more excited when we show them a human astronaut educating from space, showing what happens when you wring out a washcloth in outer space, or when you brush your teeth upside down when you're floating around in space. So Peter's absolutely right when you say it requires that humanity to self-sustain this interest and to inspire and get kids excited about it, because today's students, today's kids are going to be the innovators of tomorrow and the astronauts of tomorrow. And that's precisely what Krista McAuliffe and the Challenger 7 understood and wanted to do.
Tom referenced Columbia 2003, and I was thinking about why Columbia doesn't have the same place in our sort of cultural mind and the zeitgeist as Challenger. Yeah. I think number one, it was on reentry that we lost Columbia.
Yes.
And that always carries a little bit of a different feeling than a launch event. Second of all, there wasn't the first teacher in space. It was unfortunately we'd already had an event like Challenger, and it was such a national moment. So maybe that's why. Do you agree?
Yeah,
I would agree.
I would agree. And again, Challenger was unique. I mean, Krista McAuliffe was the inaugural teacher, right? She was not supposed to be the only teacher to go to space, just the first teacher. And Columbia, too, and remember, I mean, here we are now in 03, so I'm much older and I'm in a classroom already. They have done, I believe, at that moment, due diligence in trying to determine if any significant damage had occurred to the Columbia. They had spent the week taking thousands upon thousands of pictures to try to determine if there had been enough damage caused by the falling ice to compromise the thermal protection tiles. And they were actually already having a standby rescue mission planned, and they made the determination that not enough damage had occurred that the craft itself would be compromised. They were wrong, but I was there to witness that too. And I mean, again, but I think what I'd like to suggest, however, is the Columbia is almost forgotten in some regard. We don't teach the Columbia, right? And yet there were seven astronauts that gave their lives in their work. And yet, why do we recall the Challenger? And why is space exploration still relevant? And what I'd like to think is that Andy and I have been given this special privilege and this honor to educate those young minds that are still yet impressionable to say, what's out there? And the Columbia is this living memorial that now, 33 years later, is as relevant to the young people that come to work with us as it is to me personally and as well as to Andy. And some of this is lost. In fact, if you think of it, most of the teachers that are in classrooms now were not either in the classroom or not old enough to remember it personally. And so you even have that the educators' experience and connection to the loss of this crew is fading. And we don't want that to happen.
What's interesting, Evan, is it's now come full circle where we have teachers who bring their own classes to the Challenger mm-hmm. Learning Center who, when they were young, visited the Challenger Learning Center. So we're on our second generation now.
That's
so
right.
These are teachers who weren't old enough to remember the actual tragedy on the date it occurred, but now they are teachers themselves. And one of my favorite things that in her press tour that Krista McAuliffe had said was when asked why she's doing this. First of all, Krista McAuliffe loved field trips. She was known and loved by her students for being the queen of field trips. She called this the ultimate field trip. And one of my favorite things that she said was she's doing it because she said, I'm hoping that this will elevate the teaching profession in the eyes of the public and in the eyes of those potential teachers out there. And that's, if you digest that for a minute, she's not just teaching kids about space. She's not just encouraging kids to become astronauts. She's also encouraging kids to consider teaching and to elevate the profession of being an educator. I think that's what sets Challenger apart so much and keeps it so relevant, at least for Peter and I being in the world of education.
Let me read a couple more emails that have come in. Jamie says, hello, Commanders Robeson and Rab from Page in Fairport.
Oh, hi, Paige.
Miss Mueshausen.
And says, I can't wait to help raise money for moving the center so that other kids can continue to have experiences like I had just a couple of months ago. I had such a great time being on the data team for this field trip. I love when you guys made jokes through the speakers. Thank you so much for making it such a great time for me and my classmates.
Thank you, Paige. Thank you, Jamie.
Evan, very much.
Paige was the artist for her mm-hmm. classroom. Every class that visits us draws their own flight emblem mm-hmm. to signify their goals and represent their team. And Paige was the artist who drew hers for her class. Mm-hmm. So it gets proudly displayed on our wall of fame for mm-hmm. everybody to see. So.
And now she's one step closer to fame.
I think
now,
so.
Throw a sound out to Paige. Yeah.
And now here is Jim in Rochester saying, hello, Evan, Andy, and Peter. So glad you're highlighting their wonderful work at the Challenger Learning Center of Greater Rochester. I chaperoned my daughter's mission this past fall. They have crafted an experience to cultivate an interest in space, science, and collaborative teamwork while educating throughout, and their positivity abounds. What most people won't realize unless they've experienced this activity themselves with their kids is the way they truly connect with the children, while also making it incredibly fun, including their jokes and wit. As this is only one of 40 centers within the world, your listeners need to know that they, who they are and what this program is, and it's an absolute gem in our community. Our schools book with them a year in advance, and they need our community support. That's from Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's very kind.
So we got about a minute and a half here left here. You know, today, when this week comes, it's probably always special, always poignant for you. I just want to close by asking you, what would you tell parents in terms of educating when they're talking to their own children about understanding what happened with the Challenger and what we do moving forward?
Boy, that's a good question, Evan. I think we have to look at the dedication. The dedication to teach children was paramount in everything that they did. They knew that they had a moment to impact and affect children forever. And by engaging them and exciting them in this way, I mean, think about it, a teacher from space interacting with kids on Earth. To simplify this, think beyond the four blocks that you're allowed to ride on your bicycle. There is a whole world of excitement. And one of the things that Krista McAuliffe said is, she said, we all have to dream. We need to dream. And I'm still living her dream, right? I'm making sure that that dream of exciting, engaging, and enticing children to consider greatness is alive and well in the Rochester community. And I'm really proud to be a part of this.
And the music's going to play in a second. Commanders, will you let us know what happens, especially because we could find out as soon as next week?
We could find out as soon as next week. We'll keep you informed so that your listeners know, Evan, absolutely.
Online where? One more time.
It's www.rochesterchallenger.org. Let's do this, Rochester.
Oh.
Commanders Andy Rabb and Peter Robeson, thank you for taking the time and for educating the children and, frankly, the adults like me in our community for so many years. And I know a lot of people are hoping your work continues.
It's an honor. Thank you, Evan.
It's been a real privilege. Thank you.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.